It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This month marks 50 years since the Freedom Summer of 1964, an ambitious campaign to register African-American voters in Mississippi, a state where Jim Crow laws were in full force. On the very first day, June 21st, three young volunteers, Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Mickey Schwerner, disappeared in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Their bodies were discovered 44 days later. It was a tragedy that riveted the nation, transformed the civil rights movement, and later inspired the film Mississippi Burning. To coincide with the anniversary, a new book has been published called My Mantelpiece, a memoir of survival and social justice. The book is co-authored by Carolyn Goodman, Andrew Goodman's mother, and Brad Herzog, who joins us here in Studio A. Brad Herzog, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here. Thank you, Paul.
Carolyn Goodman began her collaboration with you just before she died in 2007, and this is the first time that a victim's family member in those Mississippi murders has revealed at length their thoughts and feelings about what happened 50 years ago. Describe how your collaboration with Carolyn Goodman came to be.
Well, it really started about a decade before she died. I've written many books, and among them are three American travel memoirs about small-town America. And the first one that I wrote, my wife Amy and I took a year-long RV trip around the country, and I wrote a book called States of Mind about towns named after virtues. Hope, Mississippi was one of them. It was Justice, West Virginia, Pride, Alabama, Wisdom, Montana. But Hope, Mississippi was one of the towns, and that happens to be right next to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where Andy Goodman, Mickey Schwerner, and James Cheney were murdered in 1964. And that's all I knew about it. So I immersed myself in that story as I was writing the chapter of that book, and I was fascinated by it and horrified by it. And I came to learn the story of Carolyn Goodman, and I wrote a magazine article about her, and then she asked me to co-author her memoirs with her. And over the course of several years, I got to know her very well, spent lots of time with her, and she unflinchingly told me her story, all the intimate moments of her personal life, which was filled with a series of tragedies, and also, you know, her thoughts and lessons learned from both before and after her son was murdered in 1964. She led a fascinating life, and that moment on June 21st, 1964 was sort of the fulcrum of what she became and who she was, because who she was why Andy Goodman went down there. Who she became was sort of a reflection of his martyrdom. And she was just a fascinating woman.
And she was an activist herself. What can you tell us about her and the causes she was involved with?
Well, her whole life she was involved with – she almost represents this 20th century progressive movement in her life. Even in college at Cornell University, she would organize dairy farmers cooperatives. She fought against Spanish fascism in the 1940s. She protected friends from the McCarthy witch hunts of the 1950s. She would protest here and there, and Andy Goodman became a reflection of that. When he was 15, he went down to West Virginia to examine the poverty of Appalachia. He went to the March on Washington, and he decided to volunteer and for Freedom Summer in 1964. And really the moment that I begin the book My Mantelpiece with is that moment that I think encapsulates everything, where he is 20 years old, so he had to get permission from his parents to go to volunteer in Mississippi. So she had this dilemma. On one hand, she wanted to protect her son from anything hurtful, anything harmful. On the other hand, he was a reflection of who she and her husband Bobby were, and they were proud of it. And how could they possibly say no? Because he wanted to help. He wanted to be a beacon of light in the heart of darkness. And how could they possibly say no to that? So they gave him permission to go, and he left the room, and she threw in some extra iodine and bandages into his duffel bags, figuring maybe he'll get beat up a little, maybe he'll even get thrown in jail. You know, never did she imagine that he would actually lose his life on this basically his first day in Mississippi.
Describe what the Freedom Summer was all about and how it became this event for idealistic young people like Andrew Goodman.
Well, it was an ambitious project, and it was an aggressive project. Roughly 700 to 900 college students were going to go down to Northern college students, mostly white, were going to go down to Mississippi and register black voters and create freedom schools that would teach disenfranchised African Americans in Mississippi about their constitutional rights. And it was a much needed project because just some of the numbers back then, roughly 5 or 6% of the African Americans in Mississippi were registered to vote in 1960. Of the 13 mostly black counties in Mississippi, in 8 of them, not a single African American had ever voted. And of the state with the highest percentage of black citizens had the lowest percentage of black voters. It was a much needed movement, but this was the sort of center. Alabama and Mississippi were the sort of center of the Jim Crow South, and sort of tragically, ironically, this anticipated movement of Freedom Summer re-energized the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. There was actually one day in April where the FBI counted 61 crosses burning in 61 different towns in Mississippi on one night in April. And they counted about 10,000 Klan members in the newly energized Ku Klux Klan. So you had this aggressive movement against this intransigent, newly energized population of segregationists. Segregationists. And it was almost a recipe for martyrdom. You know, there were more than a few people who thought there would be inevitable violence in some way. I don't think anybody truly expected the brazenness of the fact that three civil rights workers would be thrown in jail on a dubious charge. And while they were in jail, a group of about 18 or 19 KKK members, including the deputy sheriff and the sheriff most likely, planned this whole ambush and stopped them for speeding after they were released at night for jail, took them to an unlit dirt road, and shot them one at a time, and then buried their bodies under 10 tons of dirt with bulldozers. And then their bodies were missing for 44 days. And I think that aspect of it really sort of galvanized the nation, the fact that these were missing people, the fact that two of them were white was a whole different ballgame in many ways for the civil rights movement, tragically in many ways, because when they were searching for those three bodies for 44 days, amazingly, they didn't find those three bodies, but they came across many black bodies in the rivers and forests and swamps in Mississippi that had just gone ignored. In fact, one of them was a 14-year-old boy wearing he was never identified, but he's wearing a Congress of Racial Equality t-shirt. So that's just – it's a heartbreaking fact. And this tragedy really in many ways transformed the civil rights movement, and I think really led to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, because that's what they were trying to do, register voters.
What kind of guilt did Carolyn Goodman wrestle with after her son was murdered? I mean I know this comes up in the book. I'm really curious what kind of conversations you had with her and what she said about it, because I'm guessing she must have wrestled with it to some extent.
She did, certainly. I mean, there was certainly a part of her who said, well, we could have said no. We could. But then she said, well, how could I say this is what we believe in, this is what we stand for, this is what I've done in my history, but I don't want you to go down to Mississippi. You let someone else take that risk. She just couldn't come to grips with that possibility. So for the most part, she said he didn't go there planning to die. She didn't consider him a martyr. She said she didn't consider him a hero. She said he was just a good boy who was a tragic loss to his mother and father. But he became a martyr, and she embraced that. She turned his martyrdom into a mission to further better the world. She turned that anguish into action. She created the Andrew Goodman Foundation in 1966 that for nearly 50 years now has been devoted to human rights and civil rights and voting rights and intergenerational cooperation and youth activism. It's a great cause. In fact, half of the proceeds from my mantelpiece are going directly to the Andrew Goodman Foundation. So she really turned it into something positive. She, you know, even years and decades later when I was talking to her, she would tear up, obviously, talking about it. But I think she, in the end, was proud that his legacy represents a noble cause. Now, there have been times where I've heard Andy Goodman's younger brother, David Goodman, interviewed, and the interviewer has said, well, I guess it maybe makes you feel better that at least he gave his life for a noble cause. And I've heard David Goodman sort of gently correct the interviewer and say, well, just to correct you, he didn't give his life. His life was taken from him. And that's an interesting distinction. It's a bold distinction. And so he didn't – you know, obviously he didn't think there was that level of risk going down there. But still he went down there, which was such a courageous act. Everyone involved with that whole movement was so courageous, not the least the fact that after they went missing, there were some 300 soon-to-be volunteers up in Ohio training to go down to Freedom Summer, and many of their parents said, "You're not going. We don't want to, you know, we don't want you to go." And only 10 of the 300 ended up not going. I mean, that's courageous too. So, what a just special movement in our nation's history that is.
And certainly, you know, the three among the many civil rights workers that went down to Mississippi, Andrew Goodman and also James Cheney and Mickey Schwerner, you know, but before they went, that, you know, the Emmett Till incident had happened. I mean, there were plenty of incidents to make you want to think twice about going down there. You know, it was certainly something that took a great deal of courage. The question that comes up is when people look at the results of the Freedom Summer in terms of new voters registered, that number was disappointingly small, only a few hundred registered voters. It prompted Martin Luther King to say that at that rate, it would take 270 years to register all the eligible black voters in Mississippi. So what, you know, in addition to the martyrdom, what ultimately was gained from the Freedom Summer?
Well, I think, you know, I think the fact that, well, it's easy to answer that in terms of the tragedy that happened. The tragedy had the, I suppose, fortunate effect of galvanizing the nation more and making, and especially white America, and just having, allowing people to realize the absolute brazenness and sort of backwater philosophy that was there. And I think that, you know,
it basically exposed this, and it also exposed this mentality of the Jim Crow supporters in the South and the Klan members who said that the only thing worse than someone who is the N-word is someone who is an N-word lover.
Right. And it became evident that they would stop at nothing, apparently, to hold on to their way of life. And I think it opened a lot of people's eyes to including Lyndon Johnson and people in Washington, D.C. I really do think that more than indirectly led to the Voting Rights Act. And I think it also made people realize that something aggressive had to be done, and that there you can't get achievement without risk in this case, and you had to face things head on, because otherwise they weren't going to let anything change. And you know, even the trial of these three victims took place in 1967. They couldn't accuse the 19 men were eventually arrested for these murders, and they couldn't accuse them of murder because that would be a state trial, and the state really hadn't done a true investigation, or neither had the county. So they had to make it a federal offense of depriving the victims of their civil rights. It was a Reconstruction era statute. So it was somewhat of a mockery, and the only seven men ever went to jail, and none for longer than 6 years. And they ambushed and murdered three people. And it wasn't until 41 years later, in fact, 41 years to the day of the murders, that the sort of ringleader of the ambush, and I use that term, the mastermind, I use that term loosely, was convicted of three counts of manslaughter and a 20-year sentence each consecutively. So he was 80 years old, a man named Edgar Ray Killen. That's actually his name. And he can live to be 138 years old. He's still going to spend the rest of his life in jail. So that's a positive to take from it. And Carolyn Goodman actually at age 89 went down to Mississippi and testified at the trial and read a postcard that she had received from her son Andy on the day that he arrived in Mississippi just before he was killed. They were told to send a positive message. So it just said that we've arrived in Mississippi. Our welcome has been great. The people here are kind. All my love, Andy. And they received that postcard 2 days after he went missing. So she still had that for many years.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Brad Herzog, co-author with Carolyn Goodman of the book My Mantelpiece, a memoir of survival and social justice. You had a chance to spend a lot of time with Carolyn Goodman. She spent a lot of years before she passed away dealing with that heartache. And you know, when you, it's very revealing when you tell a story of how when she talked about her son, she would tear up. How did she? How was she able to bear up for all those years to go to Mississippi and testify? Just deal with it emotionally.
Well, she was a strong woman. She was not shy in her opinions, and she had a tough life. I mean, her older brother died when she was 5 years old. Her father committed suicide 2 weeks before her wedding. She was molested as a child. Her son was murdered in Mississippi. Her beloved husband Bobby, who I wish I could have met, seems like a wonderful man, died at age 55 suddenly. So she had this series of tragedies, but she kept overcoming and surviving. And then I think she immersed herself in devoting herself to making sure that her son did not die in vain. And I think that was sort of cathartic for her. And then she had people, she had support all over the place, including in Mississippi, by the way. When she went back there in 1989 to create sort of a Freedom Summer caravan on the 25th anniversary of the murders, and among the many things she did positive after the murders, she was sitting in a room full of people, and the Secretary of State of Mississippi, a man named Dick Mulpis, in front of everyone, he was from Philadelphia, Mississippi originally, apologized for the events of 1964 publicly. And she said it was one of the most therapeutic moments of her life. She crossed the stage and they hugged in front of everyone. And she said that, you know, made all the difference in the world. And there were people like that down there too, especially in recent years. And they're also the people who didn't let this thing go and ended up getting Edgar Ray killed and put on trial. So she found hope. And I think, you know, I originally became introduced into the story through Hope, Mississippi, through visiting that town next to Philadelphia. And I think that is the lasting legacy of Carolyn Goodman, is this message of hope that she's youth activism. There are youth activists out there that the Andrew Goodman Foundation supports. And she just wants to remind people that they are out there and that they're standing on the shoulders of giants.
My guest has been Brad Herzog. He's co-author with Carolyn Goodman of My Mantelpiece, a memoir of survival and social justice, as we reflect on the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Summer of 1964. Brad Herzog, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.
Coming up, a look at Carnegie Museum of Natural History's race exhibit. It's a Central Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.